Hello and welcome to another episode of Damn Interesting Week. We are so glad you've decided to join us. My name is Jennifer Lee Noonan.
I'm Angela Epley.
I'm Whisper Chen.
I'm Bradley Calhoun.
And this was a Damn Interesting Week. So let's get started with our first link.
First link.
All right. From New Atlas, scientists have now shown that gold outperforms common weight loss drugs.
What?
So if you can't afford Ozempic, don't worry. There's always gold.
So like Goldschlager is good for you. It's like, y'all don't know what that is, do you? Oh, that's so sad.
Oh, okay. No, I do, unfortunately.
Okay.
Okay, so maybe if you take Goldschlager and you just shake it up a lot so those particles get really small. I mean, really small.
Oh, they have to be small. Okay.
Yeah, we're talking like nanoparticle small.
All right.
But the idea here is that there is a growing body of evidence that gold nanoparticles can offer significant targeted weight loss that not only focuses on fat tissue, lipids, it leaves muscle structure alone. Now, the numbers are impressive. 36% targeted fat loss over 9 weeks compared to a typical 10 or 20% with the GLP-1 drugs.
Hmm.
And up to 20% of that can be attributed to muscle loss, which, yikes. But to be fair, the scientists have only conducted animal studies so far. But in the study they did with rats, the researchers compared different doses of the gold nanoparticles. So they had a control with no treatment. And then they had an existing weight loss drug, Orlistat, brand name Xenical. And what they found is that high weekly doses of the gold nanoparticles significantly reduced body fat, increased muscle mass, and boosted metabolic markers in obese animals. There was also evidence of improved blood sugar levels and reduced inflammation and oxidative stress. Histological assessment also revealed that gold nanoparticles repaired liver and kidney tissue. Whereas if you take the Orlistat, the semaglutide, your organs actually are adversely affected. There's potential damage occurring there.
Mm-hmm.
Now, we have no direct comparison of the GLP-1s and the gold nanoparticles yet. But given the evidence for muscle protection, we're thinking that it could be a complementary treatment, not a direct competitor or a replacement, which is interesting given the efficacy. But my guess is getting gold just right for health is going to be even more expensive than just getting the gold in the first place.
Yeah, I mean, gold nanoparticles are in like pregnancy tests and stuff. It's not that expensive.
Yeah.
It's more about the preparation.
Yeah, and we're, to your point, we're already using these. We currently use gold nanoparticles in a bunch of treatments, including cancer therapy and in drug delivery.
Hmm.
But a human obesity trial in particular remains elusive, and this is largely due to health unknowns. Like, could too many gold nanoparticles maybe actually become toxic? Question mark?
Sure, probably.
Right. If I start wearing a whole bunch of gold chains, will those leach into my skin?
Yeah, would just lick them on occasion. I was just thinking, it does explain why, like, ye old-timey prospectors were always super skinny dudes and really old. Like, they lived a long time.
Yeah.
Okay, next link.
Next link.
This article comes to us from El País in their science category. It's titled, Mammals, Birds, and Reptiles Evolved Complex Brains Through Different Paths.
Hmm.
So, butterflies, pigeons, and bats have one thing in common. They fly. Common sense might suggest that despite belonging to different families, they share a common winged ancestor on the tree of life. However, their closest ancestor is an ancient worm-like creature that did not even have wings. This is a clear example of evolutionary convergence, where vastly different species have independently evolved the same solution, wings, to solve the same problem, flight.
Mm-hmm.
A similar phenomenon has occurred in the brains of birds, reptiles, and mammals. According to 3 studies published in Science, their gray matter has evolved to perform complex functions using different neural paths and circuits to reach the same destination. Mammalian brains have a distinctive anatomy with convolutions and grooves that provide greater capacity. In fact, the rest of the taxa lack the neocortex, the outermost part of the pallium, responsible for the most advanced functions. Fernando Garcia Moreno at the Achucaro Basque Center for Neuroscience is the lead author of two of the three studies on vertebrate brain evolution published in Science. Garcia Moreno says, mammals have an enlarged pallium and a gigantic cortex. When you compare it with that of a gecko, for example, you see that the pallium is just another part. But then we saw that birds, which are sauropsids like most reptiles, don't have a cortex. Their neurons are grouped into nuclei. Focusing on birds, Garcia Moreno's team, in collaboration with researchers from Swedish, Canadian, and Spanish institutions, studied neurogenesis and the development of sensory circuits in chickens. Specifically, they examined the emergence of the two main types of neurons found in every brain, particularly in the pallium, excitatory neurons and inhibitory neurons. These function like the brain's on-off switches. Excitatory neurons send signals across different brain regions to drive communication, while inhibitory neurons regulate, refine, and sometimes even block those signals. Moreno explains, "Our research shows that inhibitory neurons are surprisingly similar in birds and mammals, suggesting they existed in a shared ancestor over 320 million years ago and have changed very little since then. However, excitatory neurons evolved in a much more dynamic way." Taken together, these results show that the similarity of the neural circuits in birds and mammals is the result of evolutionary convergence rather than coming from the common ancestor. But we should note that this applies primarily to terrestrial animals, and other cases, such as the octopus, challenge any definitive conclusions. The fact that excitatory neurons differ significantly between birds and mammals implies that these two lineages achieve similar circuit architecture in different ways, which means they've basically found two different ways to develop intelligence, which is pretty wild. It kind of makes me think of like the neuron equivalent of carcinogenesis, where everything converges to becoming a crab at one point or another.
Yeah, well, and it gives us opportunities to bully the octopuses more, which is what we want. Like,
they have brains in every one of their arms. How can you bully an octopus? Come
on. They're going to win. That's the conclusion.
Right. The moment they invent guns, we're in trouble. Next link.
Next link.
We'll stay in the realm of biology. This comes from The Guardian. It won't end like Jurassic Park, the man who wants to bring the mammoth and the dodo back to life says.
I like that he's focusing on the cuddly ones. Like, we're just talking about an elephant and a dodo bird. No scary lizards.
Not lizards, but we'll get to one of the other animals that he's trying to bring in. So Colossal Biosciences founder Ben Lamb is working to revive the woolly mammoth and the dodo. But he wants to make clear the ending will be different to that of Steven Spielberg's gory dinosaur epic. Quote, people have to remember that that was a movie, right? Size. Sitting in the Hard Rock Cafe on the fringes of the World Economic Forum in Davos. That's where they stuck us.
Yeah.
You guys are going to the Hard Rock Cafe. You love that, right? No. Quote, we've also seen like Ready Player One, and that doesn't exist. But people are like, didn't we see how Jurassic Park ended? Like, yeah, it was a scripted ending. So I'll do a scripted show and I'll make the ending great. And then you guys will talk about that. Colossal Biosciences, which has labs in Dallas, Texas, Cambridge, Massachusetts, and Melbourne, Australia, recently announced that it has completed a $2 million funding round. Past investors have included Lord of the Rings filmmaker Peter Jackson.
Oh.
Well, because it would save him money if he can get big monsters for his films without having to CGI them.
Yeah, it's way cheaper.
I'd like to think he's just trying to get them to make a little salacious crumb for his own, like, personal pet use.
Right.
He reiterates the company's claim that it hopes to bring the first woolly mammoth calf into the modern world, born to a surrogate elephant mother by late 2028. The company is simultaneously working on giving birth to animals using artificial wombs in a lab, something Lamb says they may achieve with a small mammal, perhaps a mouse, within 2 years, and maybe a human clone in 10. It's this latter process that Lamb hopes could be used to protect existing animal species. All right, there's some good in it, maybe. Such as the vanishing rare northern white rhino from dying out. Alongside the mammoth and the dodo, he also hopes to revive an extinct Tasmanian marsupial called the thylacine, which is, I don't know if y'all have seen it. It's the weirdest looking animal. Half of its body is like tiger striped, but front of it looks kind of like a dodo.
Okay.
It's a weird animal, but it doesn't exist anymore.
That we know of.
Yeah, there is some debate, but they're extinct. Despite his determination to repudiate the ending, Lamb concedes that there are distinct parallels between the fictional process of bringing velociraptors back from the dead and his eye-catching de-extinction process. Like the scientists in the Spielberg classic, experts at Colossal Biosciences start out with a sample of the creature's DNA not gathered from mosquitoes, but from historical specimens. Quote, "First, you have to get ancient DNA, right? And that exists sometimes in museums. A lot of researchers have actually already done the work." By the way, the thylacine died in 1935. I'm not sure if it's ancient, but I see his point.
Mm-hmm.
Instead of filling in the gaps in these genetic samples with frog DNA, as it was in the movie, Lamb's team starts with the closest living relative to the beast they are trying to bring back from the dead. In the case of the mammoth, it's the Asian elephant. It's 99.6 the same genetically. Then you do some comparative genomics using AI to understand what genes are persistent and what are the characteristics of those genes. I would also like to point out that the dog and wolf have a 0.1 genetic difference, so that 0.4% isn't trivial.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
No. They then take an elephant cell and, quote, engineer in the specific genes that are essential to the mammoth using a process called somatic cell nuclear transfer. This was pioneered in Edinburgh, where Dolly, the famous sheep, was cloned.
Mm.
He says, "Like the sheep, only now we use robotics and lasers. Back then, they were using like this," he says, picking up a knife and gesturing.
All right.
Was this guy actually just Billy Mays reincarnated?
Yeah, he says like a lot. So it's really hard for me not to do like a California voice with him.
Mm-hmm. At least they quoted him verbatim so that the surfer vibe remained intact.
Mm-hmm.
But for birds, the process is different. So they are in the editing phase on cells on both the mammoth and the thylacine, but not quite there with the dodo. They still are doing some computational biology work, so they think they're going to have that announcement in the next 6 months or so.
Mm.
His dream is to ultimately create herds or flocks of them to roam free in Madagascar, or in the case of woolly mammoths, across the frozen plains of the Arctic tundra.
Because they're going to be frozen forever, right?
Right. Asked whether vast tusked mammals would destroy everything in their path, he points to research suggesting that restoring such keystone herbivores may actually help the wider environment. Again, I can see some truth in this. People generally agree that a more biodiverse ecosystem is a healthier one. And in the article, they mentioned many tech founders turn to passion products at certain ages in their career. So for Bill Gates, it was tackling malaria. For Elon Musk, it's clotheslining the U.S. government.
Right.
Lamb's successful startups were on a much smaller scale, but he has already co-founded and sold 5 companies, giving him the financial leeway to follow his enthusiasm for restoring long-forgotten species. These companies include Conversable, which he calls a precursor to large language models, and the creative company Chaotic Moon Studios, which was bought by Accenture in 2015. So I looked up Chaotic Moon Studios. You guys want to know some of their stuff?
What do they make?
They make the smartest cart. It's a shopping cart that follows you around.
Oh.
They make Tech Tats, which is skin-mounted components and conductive paint to live in the human body and form a tattoo that collects and stores data.
Okay.
Mm. Fitcoin, which pays the users to work out in Bitcoin. I'm not sure how that works.
Oh, my God.
And a camera drone for police cars. The only reason I'm bringing this up, it just may show that this might not come to the same fruition.
Right. None of those things are things we see in our daily lives. So,
nor are they meant to really enhance humanity. Everything else that you've listed is a really good weapon to continue policing the status quo. So the only logical extension of a dodo bird or a calf is that it's going to grow up to hold the thin blue line. Why?
I don't know, though. A dodo bird RoboCop would be really cute. Like, you got
Dodo
to admit.
Dodo Robo!
Okay, to be fair to him a little bit, he is working with George Church, George Church, if you don't know, is kind of the father of synthetic biology. He's the one who figured out all the gene splicing. He has insane amounts of companies out there doing it. He's kind of responsible for the process of gene splicing. It's kind of his bag. So he is working on it with him because he said that was the thing he wanted to do. So at least he's got George Church working with him. Now, I'm not sure George Church has the best ethics out there. He just cares about how things work. Hasn't zoomed out on a lot of things of his work, but there are some things that he's done, I do have to admit, that have done some great things for humanity. But it has already spun out two businesses, and Lamb says it will do it again, potentially as soon as this year, where its work creates standalone technologies that may be commercial viable.
Yep.
But whatever the economic benefits, Lamb says he hopes that if his implausible sounding project succeeds, it will inspire a new generation of would-be biologists.
And a lot more movies from Peter Jackson. So I guess we can all get on board.
Exactly. Next link.
Next link.
All right. Next up, we have an entry in Smithsonian Mag's On This Day in History series, where it turns out that 57 years ago, on February 16th, 1968, the first 911 call was placed.
Oh.
Yeah. Now, unfortunately for our true crime fans out there, the call itself was not an actual call for help. It was an official demonstration of the new system where Rankin Fight, the Speaker of the Alabama House of Representatives, made the first call on the new national number from Haleyville, Alabama, and it was answered by Representative Tom Bevel at the local police station. But it was a big deal because there had been a lot of work put in to make this moment happen. Because it's not like nobody had ever thought of the idea before. The UK was actually ahead of us by several decades on this, having implemented their national 999 system all the way back in 1937. But, you know, to be fair, the UK is much smaller than the US, and what we had instead at the time was a huge variety of regional systems of varying levels of success. In some rural areas, for example, the recognized method was to shoot off fireworks if there had been an emergency on your farm.
Well, that's too vague.
Yeah. So by 1957, the National Association of Fire Chiefs formally recommended the use of a nationwide number. And in 1966, a federal report titled Accidental Death and Disability, The Neglected Disease of Modern Society, highlighted a number of steps the government should take, including, quote, designating a single nationwide telephone number to summon an ambulance.
Yeah.
Now, some people claim, according to the article, that the high-profile rape and murder of Kitty Genovese in 1964 also helped fuel support for an emergency phone number, which, if you're not familiar with the case, her assault was famously witnessed by no less than 38 people, none of whom called the police or stepped in to try to help. And the article notes that actually subsequent research has cast doubt on the real circumstances of that crime, but it is a fact that the news narrative at that time was definitely 38 witnesses, lots of outrage. So it is possible that those events may have increased support just because of people's perceptions.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's links to all these historical arguments if you really want to go down that rabbit hole. Regardless, by 1967, the President's Commission on Law Enforcement and Administration of Justice formally recommended a hotline, which then caused the FCC to start a collaboration with the largest phone operator at that time, AT&T. And it was actually somebody at AT&T who suggested a three-digit number so that it would be easier to remember in an emergency. Hmm. And shortly after that, Congress officially passed legislation, not that the service must be implemented necessarily, but that the phone number 911 would be nationally reserved for emergency services and could not be used for any other purpose. Because even after the first official service was connected in Alabama, it still took a really long time for it to truly become national. Almost a decade later, in 1976, only 17% of the country had an active 911 service. And wow. Even by 1987, that figure had only risen to 50%.
Like,
what?
When I was a kid, only half the country had 911. That's insane to me.
I didn't know that. I thought it was a fully national. I mean, that was how it was pitched up.
Yeah, I mean, it was basically in cities is what it was. Any major urban area had it, but outside that, it was touch and go.
Huh.
Fortunately, it is almost universal today, and the only areas that technically don't have it are places that don't have phone service at all. Because you can get it on your cell phone, so anywhere you can get cell phone service, you have it.
Huh.
And there are still groups pushing for more advancements, and they are slowly getting them. One recent improvement, which you've probably seen for yourself, is that most cell phones can now make an emergency call even if you can't unlock the phone.
Mm-hmm.
You can also text 911 in certain areas now. And they're hoping in some areas to start offering video calls to 911, which they think could help an operator assess a situation when the caller can't necessarily speak. Right. You just sort of aim the camera around the carnage and be like, this is what we're looking at.
And yeah, then probably get more false calls, too.
Could be.
Like, it's my face. Yeah. Well, I guess you could just call and point it at something.
Yeah. I mean, you know, a false call is still something you can do now. And it does carry a heavy fine.
That's true.
But, you know, I don't know if y'all have ever used 911. I've personally called it at least 3 times. So I have a special what? Place in my heart. Yeah. Maybe I just have a very dangerous life. I don't know.
Yeah, I've never called it.
Really? Yeah. I mean, no. They weren't all for me. One was for me. One was for my father and one was for my son. But like, I won't say that it was honestly a great experience all 3 times, only because like the people who answered seemed so mellow and slow. And I'm like, could you please talk faster? You know, and they're like, okay. And what is the address? And I get that part of their job is to calm you down. Mm-hmm. But I was calm. Mm-hmm. I was like, let's move faster here, people. Come on. Yeah. Like,
they're going to definitely replace that with AI who can't get flustered. But I can only imagine the absolute. No, you need to speak to an actual human being when it comes to this stuff.
Well, because sometimes it's a little kid calling or sometimes, you know, it's somebody who can't speak clearly, but a person can kind of figure it out. Also, I think it's ridiculous that they ask you the address at all because they can trace where you're coming from. Mm-hmm. They famously are able to say somebody called but said nothing. We're going to where that phone is located. So I don't know why they make you waste your time giving addresses anyway. Somehow this has turned into a rant against 911, and it really isn't. I like the service.
Thank you
I'm very
your
grateful
service.
For it. Exactly. Next link.
Next link.
All right, from the BBC. If you felt it, you are probably already aware that the Earth's inner core may have changed shape.
Wow. I didn't
feel it. That's what I've been feeling this whole time.
Yeah, we've been talking about this being the weird timeline. I think we may have a cause, y'all. Wink, wink. The inner core of Earth may have changed shape in the past 20 years, according to a group of scientists. Yeah, I'm not kidding. If you felt it in the last 20 years, the inner core is usually thought to be shaped like a ball. But its edges may actually have deformed by about 100 meters or more in height in places. Hmm. That's according to Professor John Vidal, who led the research. Now, Earth's core is the beating heart of our planet because it produces a magnetic field that protects life from burning up in the sun's radiation. Now, it spins independently from the liquid outer core and from the rest of the planet. Without this motion, Earth would die and become more barren, like Mars, which lost its magnetic field billions of years ago.
Hmm.
Now, the core is about 4,000 miles from the Earth's surface, and despite our best efforts, scientists so far have been unable to reach it. My guess is everything keeps melting.
It's not because there's a secret society living inside the hollow Earth. I mean,
they're not letting us get there.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, magical wards, you know. But to unlock the secrets that we have been able to, some researchers measure the shock waves caused by earthquakes as they ripple through the planet. So the way that the waves travel reveals what type of material they moved through. And that can include the inner core. So this new analysis looked at seismic wave patterns from earthquakes that repeated in the same location between 1991 and 2023, and that helped to show how the inner core is changing over time. Professor Vidal found more evidence to back up the theory that during those years, the inner core slowed down. But his team also found the evidence of the inner core's changing shape. And yeah, it seems to be at the boundary of inner and outer core, where the inner core is close to melting point. The liquid flow of the outer core, as well as pull from an uneven gravity field, might be what's causing this deformation. He said it could allow scientists to make more informed estimates of some important material properties, like the viscosity of the inner core, which is one of the least known quantities in modern science. And you know that's got to just be a crock. Modern science loves its metrics.
Right. They need to know that viscosity. How can you sleep at night without knowing it?
Over time, the liquid outer core is freezing into the solid inner core, but it's going to be billions of years, according to the data we have now, before it becomes completely solid. which would almost certainly mean the end of life on Earth. Mm-hmm. But by then, the planet is already likely to be swallowed by the sun, so don't even worry.
I've heard it referred to as kind of like an orange.
Mm.
So like an orange is still solid, but you can squish it.
Squishy. See, there's your viscosity answer right there, scientists. Like, you don't need anything else.
That's right. Find the juice sacks. It's all over from there. All right, next link.
Next link.
Got a short one from lithub.com. It's titled The Curious Case of the Stolen F. Scott Fitzgerald Statue. So, a statue of the Long Island jazz bard was removed from outside a Minnesota building where the author once attended school, a place formerly known as the St. Paul Academy.
Hmm.
The building's current owner commissioned Aaron Dysart, a mixed media artist fascinated with the intersection of the built and non-built environment, to design the sculpture. Runaway F. Scott was first reported missing 2 weeks back on February 3rd, but the political will to find him did not reach fever pitch until a few days later.
What?
And per a local police report, the perp apparently fetched the bolt cutters. The statue is believed to have been cut free. So we have the how, the who, the where, but the why still evades us. For what kind of fandom motivates someone to free a statue? You might picture the late great novelist perched in a bookstore's back room, perhaps on a plinth of his own out-of-print lesser works. Or maybe he's made it into the custody of whatever diehards are responsible for the Jazz Age lawn party, which is a gigantic kind of Fitzgerald-themed lawn party. Actual jazzagelawnparty.com is linked here. So if you're really into that vibe, maybe check it out. And then again, F. Scott, like his own bespoke Gatsby, had many enemies in life. So maybe this is theft could be the work of a Hemingway freak. But the artist is in the dark along with the rest of us. Dysart told NPR, "I'm still kind of processing. I don't even know what to think about it. On the one hand, as a joke, I'm like, wow, somebody liked it as much enough to steal it. But who knows what happened to it?" The building owner estimates that the statue, which is bronze, will cost about $40,000 to replace.
Wow.
But police suggest the metal could fetch several hundred dollars at a scrapyard.
Or it could just been somebody who misinterpreted it and thought it was just another racist statue of a white guy.
Could be.
Yeah.
I mean, it could also be the building owner who's like, you know, I haven't gotten enough attention from this expensive statue I commissioned. We'll make it disappear and then it'll quietly come back, no questions asked. And now everyone's going to be like, oh, our favorite statue has returned and come see it.
Or they hated that statue but needed it valuated. So they now have a $40K estimated that they can now get from insurance to make a much better statue of something they like better.
Could be. $40K is a lot.
Yeah, they did mess up a little bit, though, in a last poetic twist. There is still a piece of the original lingering around, which is Fitzgerald's red right hand. And so it's just there on the floor, it seems, or wherever it was installed.
Nick Cave literally covered
just,
it.
Yeah,
Nick Cave
piece
knew
of hand.
All along. Oh, my gosh.
Now it's an homage to the Addams Family and Thing. It's just...
Next link.
Next link.
All right. So this is from Popular Mechanics. This new LiDAR technology can recognize your face from a full kilometer away.
Oh, dear.
Oh.
Light detection and ranging, LiDAR, first developed by the Hughes Aircraft Company in 1961, is a tech you may not think about often, but scientists and engineers and archaeologists these days find it impossible to live without. By timing laser pulses to measure distance with immense accuracy, the technology has been a game changer for robotics, autonomous vehicles like Waymo cars, ocean seafloor mapping, and again, archaeology. So mapping trees and removing the trees. It's pretty cool tech. However, like all technologies, there's always room for improvement. And a new study led by Heriot-Watt University in Edinburgh, including scientists from NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory, MIT, and the University of Glasgow, you know, idiots, detailed the creation of superconducting LiDAR system capable of accurately capturing 3D data up to an astonishing 1 kilometer away with a resolution at the millimeter scale. This breakthrough was only possible due to an ultra-sensitive sensor called the Superconducting Nanowire Single Photon Detector, SNSPD for short. Co-developed by NASA and MIT, the system can track a single photon to an accuracy of just 13 picoseconds, so 13 trillionths of a second,
Wow.
Which is 10 times better than any system timing that currently exists.
Could this even like capture retinal scans at a distance? Because that level of precision yes. is okay.
It will in the future. There's a picture that they include in here of George Taylor. He's a research co-author. They took a snapshot of his face and successfully recorded depths with an accuracy of, again, 1 millimeter. And you can see it. There's a 3D kind of picture of his face with his beard. All the individual hairs are there. It's pretty insane. So, of course, this kind of supersight means that the possible applications for this tech, especially in the military, are readily apparent.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. If you've already got the facial recognition tech, this is just taking a picture from a really, really long distance.
They've already been doing this at like Madison Square Garden, where if you've acted the fool and they've got your name on file, their face recognition technology can pick you out of a crowd and kick you out.
More importantly, it could distinguish an object located a few centimeters behind camouflage netting.
Okay.
Which we couldn't do before. The
The
secret superpower of this system is that it can be used during the day with extreme accuracy. Normally, scattered light from the sun can interfere with measurements, but because SNSPD uses wavelengths at 1550 nanometers, it avoids this clutter. Also being eye safe, they put that in quotes, according to the researchers. The mid-infrared wavelength also alludes to the initial idea behind the SNSPD's creation. This is a powerful detector for exploring exoplanets, and mid-infrared wavelengths can go. So this makes them an attractive technology for proposed MIR exoplanet climate explorer or the large interferometer for exoplanets. Life, for short. Do you think they start from life and then work backwards? However, like dozens of NASA science breakthroughs that eventually impact our daily lives, like the memory foam, this one will improve LiDAR, but one of the big drawbacks of the system is that it isn't exactly small. The word superconducting in the SNSPD essentially translates to ultra-cold temperatures. So the system needs to be cryocooled, chilled down to 1 Kelvin. So don't worry anytime soon. It's still just in the labs.
They're not going to be traveling around with this on a truck. And if they do, you'll see them coming.
Right. It'll be a big truck. But again, we might put it in satellites. That's kind of the intent of it.
So they'll be able to see the tops of our heads in amazing resolution. But as long as you're not sunbathing, they can't see your face.
That's right.
All right. Well, that is all we have time for today. We're so glad you've joined us. Some of the articles we did not have time to get to today include: chronic stress affects the way mice perceive loudness, the teeming life of dead trees, and how to prepare for your digital afterlife. So all that and more, plus everything we talked about today, can be found on DamnInteresting.com. If you like our podcast and want to support us, you can do so at patreon.com/DamnInteristingWeek. In the meantime, my name is Jennifer Lee Noonan.
I'm Angela Epley.
I'm Whisper Chen.
I'm Bradley Calhoun.
And we hope you have a damn interesting week. Bye-bye.